So last weekend, Joy and I made it to and from Laurelville Mennonite Camp in Pennsylvania almost as scheduled, which was an improvement, I guess, on last year's extended five-day weekend. I just shook my head, though, on Friday morning as I anticipated the arrival of the van driven by Mark Diller Harder when I received a text from him telling me that he was delayed by a flat tire. He got it replaced, and just about an hour later than planned, we were on our way and made it safely to our destination. I kid you not, though, on Saturday morning, as we waited for the first session, a camp staff person came up to Mark beside me with a picture on her phone and said, "Is this your van?" Completely flat tire. Same one. I just looked at him and I said, "Mark, people are going to stop believing our stories." Well, two consecutive flat tires are not so dramatic when you start reading through the parts that we have in the book of Acts about the life story of Paul the Apostle. And I might go back and forth between calling him Paul and Saul in the next 5 weeks. It's likely that he always had both of these names, and that Paul or Paulus would have been his Roman family name, and Saul his personal Hebrew name. If he had a Roman first name or given name, that's been lost to history. He likely started being called Paul more, as we see in the text, as he moved further out into the Roman Empire, where his Hebrew name was less common. So that being said, the text today does call him Saul, all through Acts 7, 8, and 9, as we've heard, and it is a tale full of drama. Saul steps into the spotlight as a young man who just can't turn away from a good execution. By his own words, many years later, he was far more zealous for the traditions of his ancestors than his peers. He was a fanatic, passionately against this new heresy that focused on Jesus of Nazareth. Nazareth, incidentally, being a part of the world that he probably would have called by the same derogatory term that Trump apparently used this week to describe Haiti, El Salvador, and countries in Africa. Can anything good come out of there? A suspicious soon-to-be disciple of Jesus once asked. So Saul appears to be pretty buddy-buddy with the high priest, who was also present at Stephen's murder, while Saul held people's coats. And in Acts 9, Saul asks the high priest for letters to take to the synagogues in Damascus, enabling Saul in his work of rooting out the heresy of the way. And I have a couple of maps for you, too, in case you couldn't see the map the children were looking at. There are lots of lines here. We'll come back to some of those lines. But this is today, right? So Jerusalem, Damascus, and we got our little walking person going about 59, 60 hours. So that's what it would take you today to walk. So this is the part of the map we're looking at of where Saul was going from Jerusalem to Damascus. But it's on Saul's way to Damascus that a dramatic transformation begins for him. On CBC's Metro Morning this week, if you listen to it, they did a series of hearing people's do-over stories, major changes that they chose or that happened to them. Saul's do-over story might have sounded like, okay, yeah, so I was arresting all these heretics, trying to keep my faith community pure and faithful the way that the law teaches us. And then I actually stopped and listened to Jesus. And by that, he like basically sent a lightning bolt from heaven and blinded me, so it was hard to ignore. And very long story short, I came around, joined the mission of Jesus, and am prolifically published in the Holy Scriptures of the Way. What a call. What a conversion. What an unexpected vocation. But there really is so much more to the story. As I reflected on Saul's call to discipleship this week, other callings in the story stood out to me too. Remember that the so-called conversion of Saul is not about converting from one religion to another. Saul didn't convert from Judaism to Christianity. That would be an anachronistic way for us to look at it. Early followers of Jesus understood this rabbi as the fulfillment of God's promises to Israel, God's ongoing relationship with the Jewish people. The Way, as we hear in this text, is an appropriate nickname and powerful metaphor for what Saul became part of. In the words of New Testament prof Eric Barreto, instead of being identified by a set of beliefs, these faithful communities were known by their character in the world. Christian faith was a way of life, and one that impelled individuals and communities to leave the safe confines of home and to walk on the road God had set out. The way suggests that faith is a living, active way of life. And when faith is a living, active way of life, the call to being a disciple comes all along the way, not just a moment on the road to Damascus. So we see Ananias, for example, identified as a disciple. When the Lord calls his name in a vision, Ananias says, "Here I am, Lord." He's ready and listening. But he's not sure he likes what he hears next. Just like Saul's call started with, "Get up and go into the city," Ananias hears, "Get up and go to the street called Straight. Find and heal a man called Saul from Tarsus." Get up and go. Simple words that can carry a heavy demand. For Saul, it was get up and go into the unknown. You are not in control anymore. As for Ananias, he knew where he was being sent. He said, "Lord, I hang out at the market. I'm on that social media. We've all heard about Saul, how he's been tearing apart the church in Jerusalem. And now he's here on the word of the high priest so he can arrest more followers like me. You know that, right?" I don't know, have you ever prayed a prayer that went something like, "God, this thing that I feel like you're asking me to do, I'm here to tell you that it's not a good idea." I imagine that there are moments when we each talk ourselves into the idea that following Jesus should be safer, easier, quieter than the calls that come and threaten our equilibrium or demand something of us that we think somebody else would be better at. Well, Ananias informs Jesus that this will be dangerous, and the word back is, "Go. Go, for Saul is an instrument whom I have chosen to bring my name before the Gentiles and kings, before the people of Israel. I myself will show him how much he must suffer for the sake of my name." And Ananias goes, Saul is healed, and he starts walking in a completely different way. Now, we are given what looks like two different timelines of Paul's life at this point. The way Luke writes the book of Acts, it seems that Saul went straight into preaching about Jesus in the Damascus synagogues. If we read Paul's letter to the Galatians, though, he gives a different timeline, which includes time away in Arabia. So that's why this map maker has a little line down to Arabia and back and then back. And then also conferring one-on-one with Peter in Jerusalem before seeing other apostles. So in Galatians, Paul gives it a bigger timeline there. Presumably, the first-hand story is more accurate than the second-hand one. Although I also wonder about Paul's rose-colored glasses 15 years after the fact, as in Galatians he reports that the churches of Judea heard that the one who formerly was persecuting us is now proclaiming the faith he once tried to destroy, and they glorify God because of me. Seems a little different from Acts 9:26 that says, when Saul had come to Jerusalem, he attempted to join the disciples, and they were all afraid of him, for they did not believe that he was a disciple. So, you know, always read the whole story. And that's where another call to the risk of following Jesus comes into the story. You can turn off the maps for now. There's no vision or conversation with Jesus reported this time. There's just a person whose name means son of encouragement, Barnabas. And he lives up to his name. There's, despite the fear and the disbelief that was shared by Barnabas's fellow believers, something they all seemed to be in agreement on, Barnabas stood apart from the crowd. And he didn't only talk about Saul to the apostles. He reached out to Saul and brought him into the inner circle, speaking in his favor, but by the nature of him being there, allowing him agency to speak for himself. Okay, this was the point in my sermon preparation when I read an article that interrupted my way of seeing this story, and I couldn't unsee it. So I thought I had to at least lay my questions on the table in case anyone else shares them, then we can wrestle with them together. No sermon is ever finished. This one's just a little more obvious. So the article I read, which is thematic for today's Adult Sunday School as well, was about mob forgiveness, collective forgiveness. It referred to the type of story that just came out in the news again this week. A pastor of a Tennessee megachurch was called out for sexual assault of a teenager 20-some years ago. And so last Sunday, he gave an apology to his church for these actions. And the church gave him a standing ovation for his courage. Jonathan Hollingsworth wrote his article about a very similar event of mob forgiveness 3 years ago. And he wrote that there's a fine line between offering a perpetrator grace and denying a victim justice. And it's a line that Christian culture crosses all too often. The apostles in Acts are well aware of all of Saul's victims taken off to prison, dragged from their homes, men and women, the text says two times, which struck me this morning. And of course, the apostles hesitate to bring him in as another leader. But these are two different stories. So I guess I share the similarity that struck me that to remind us not to make the leap from the apostles' acceptance of Saul to the mob forgiveness without accountability of these other contemporary stories. Hollingsworth writes that grace goes too far, not when it forgives the unforgivable, that's not too far, but when it reaches so far in the direction of the abuser that it leaves the victims behind. So that is something to remember in our contemporary stories of grace and justice coming together. There's a great acronym for being an ally, which I think serves us here. You can put it on the screen. And I see, this is what I saw in Barnabas's actions when I first started looking at this story. So this acronym for ally: always center the impacted, listen and learn from those who live in the oppression, leverage your privilege, and yield the floor. So if I think of Saul as someone who was being kept at the margins of the Christ-following community, I see Barnabas as someone who leveraged his privilege to bring Saul into the center. That was privilege that he had, where Saul could have the floor. These were all risky calls to discipleship. Saul was sent to join and speak for the very community he had been trying to destroy, with the promise from God that I myself will show him how much he must suffer for the sake of my name. Ananias was called to be the first person to get up and go to this persecutor of the church. And Barnabas took a risk in front of his whole community to stand by a supposed enemy. The call to discipleship is not one single act. It's endless invitations that come all along the way of our lives. So I wonder if you'd be willing to take just 60 seconds of silence to consider these next questions in your own life. From our story, has your zeal, your passion, like Saul's, ever been misdirected and even harmful? Have you, like Saul, experienced a transforming call in your life? Have you ever hesitated, like Ananias, to follow a call to discipleship? Is there a way, like Barnabas, in which you have been called to be an ally? I invite you to just reflect silently for a few moments. Willing to share your thoughts and joys and concerns later is very welcome to do so.